Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Today, I was hanging upside down over part of my bridge that I'm building to weld underneath me with a very hot molten steel coming out of a machine. Yeah.
So it's like part trapeze work.
Yes. There's some days where my yoga teaching and my welding collide.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're tuned to Sound Effect. And this is 30-year-old Stephanie Osterman. By day, she's a welding student at South Seattle College, where she's building a small bridge that'll eventually find a home here on campus. By night, she's a yoga instructor. Stephanie literally stumbled onto this program. She came to South Seattle College to boost her skills as a yoga teacher, and then she found this place, the Welding and Metal Fabrication Department.
And I just fell in love. I didn't want to leave.
Why didn't you want to leave?
I don't know. It's a little scary. I think everything fun is a little scary. You know, I get burned all the time, whether or not you're wearing full protection. You know, yesterday, hot steel fell off the machine and rolled underneath me on the concrete, and I'm sitting on the floor and it burns straight through your pants.
All right, so you're covering your head.
I am, but that's just my own habit. I've got an extra bandana if you're feeling nervous.
No, I'm okay. But you'll just pour water on my body if I catch on fire.
You'll be okay. Nobody's head's caught on fire yet.
It's always a first.
One of the tools that Stephanie uses is a small torch. It's connected to two large tanks, and one is full of oxygen, and the other holds acetylene gas. Stephanie creates a spark, and then suddenly, there's a flame.
Whoa! You can see it's a very orange flame.
Do flames have different personalities? Do they talk to you?
You can, actually. I can usually tell if you add too much oxygen to a torch, you can hear it. So I'm turning this oxygen here all the way up.
What color do you want the flame to be?
Ooh. That bright blue right there. So I'm adding oxygen.
Whoa, it's like a lightsaber just went through it.
Yeah. And as you add oxygen, it turns to a bright, like whitish yellow.
Whoa, okay.
And that's how you would cut. You could hear the change and it gets sharp. The sound of the flame gets sharp.
That is super hot.
Yeah, it's very, very hot. It'll cut through, you know, 1-inch plate. The inside of the arc can be as hot as the sun.
You're holding the sun, the heat of the sun in your hands. How does it make you feel to have that heat in your hand?
It definitely makes it feel unique, right? I feel like it possesses a unique set of skills that not everybody has. And skills that I feel like are necessary to help build out our own society. Without people that know how to use welding equipment and welding machines, you don't get airplanes built, you don't get school buses or roads or buildings or anything. If you look anywhere you go, if you go to Starbucks, I guarantee something on that building is welded. So.
Okay, can you turn it off and can I hold it? Because I don't want to hold it when it's on. I don't think I'm allowed to anyway.
Right, you need adult supervision.
I thought it would be heavier. I'm going to pass this torch to you.
Thank you.
So I just passed this welding torch back to Stephanie. And that is the theme of our show today here on Sound Effect, passing the torch, which is completely appropriate because I'm handing the show back to you, Gabriel Spitzer.
Hey, Jennifer.
You've been away for a year and you're back, and it's time for you to take over the hosting gig at Sound Effect.
Man, thank you so much for, I guess, holding on to the torch for the last year. It's been really fun to be able to interact with the show as a listener instead of a maker, and to hear you doing such an awesome job hosting. And I'm really psyched that you are going to be staying on as part of the Sound Effect team. So I will be happily sharing the torch. And all the rest of you, stick around. We have a whole bunch more stories of passing the torch coming up right here on Sound Effect from 88.5. So Sharon Maeda inherited from her grandfather a way of looking at the world, a set of values that have guided her for her whole life. He taught her the importance of service and that helping people in need was a priority. When Sharon thinks back to the time she spent with her grandfather, one memory that's really clear is when they would go out into the community, talking to people and bringing them fruit. Sound Effect contributor Yuko Kodama has her story.
Hi, would you like an orange?
Sure, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Would you like an orange?
Sure. Sharon Maeda is a longtime activist, educator, and community organizer in the Seattle area. She's on the Route 7 bus heading north on Seattle's Rainier Avenue, and she's passing out oranges to fellow commuters. She's reliving a memory of her grandfather. See, when Sharon was little, growing up in Portland, as in barely potty trained, her grandfather Rikichi Maeda took her on outings to visit his friends by bus. They always took fruit. The trips took them through tough areas of town.
They lived in sort of like tenements. I remember we would sometimes climb back fire escape stairs, and sometimes we would go down dingy hallways, and we would visit these people and not stay long. My grandfather wasn't one with a lot of words, but, you know, they would chit-chat for a few minutes, and then my job as a little child is I got to reach into the bags and give them an apple and an orange. And I think it had a huge influence on me because I got to interact in my childish way with all different kinds of people from different ethnic backgrounds and with physical disabilities. And these were Grandpa's friends, and I just adored my grandfather. So I never had any fear or hesitation to engage with people of different backgrounds, ever.
So who was this man, Rikichi Maeda? He was born and raised in Japan and came to the United States when he was about 19. He was one of the young Japanese immigrants who finished building the Transcontinental Railroad. Then he became a Red Cap for Union Pacific in Portland.
The Red Cap are the luggage guys.
These were the men who carried the luggage for passengers from the taxi to the train. They hauled the luggage around, but they never traveled on the trains.
Being a Red Cap at the train station, there would sometimes be families that missed the train, and that's the last train out to wherever they were going until the next day. You know, they would be all panicked that they missed their train, and he would say, well, come with me, you can stay at my house. And he would bring them home on the bus and put them up for the night. He did that quite frequently.
Years later, as an adult, Sharon found herself doing similar things. For instance, she would bring women who were just getting out of prison into her own home.
Because they had to often get enough money in a savings account so that the courts would let them get custody of their children back. And I could usually get them some job. You know, I guess I got that from my grandfather. I was never afraid that they were going to steal anything, and they never did.
Back on the bus, some people are on their way to work. Others are heading home, and some people are simply using the bus as a safe place to rest. Sharon walks the aisle, reliving her childhood memories of the time she spent with her grandfather. This tiny middle-aged woman walks up to each person and offers them a piece of fruit.
So would you like some oranges?
Okay, thank you.
For Kenny Wolfork, sitting near the front, this juicy fruit is exactly what he needs.
I just got done smoking a joint, and I'm really parched. It's really refreshing right now. I think it's a generous thing that she's doing. It kind of makes me wish I was a little more giving.
You know, it's interesting. Some people are like, what is going on? I don't want to deal with anybody strange. But so many people were very warm. There were many stories that people were willing to talk about their grandparents.
Sharon strikes up a conversation with 17-year-old Michaela McGee sitting toward the middle of the bus. She's headed to work at a sandwich shop.
My grandpa was actually a bus driver, so I used to just go and ride the bus with him, or we used to go feed the homeless a lot, me and my grandparents.
Oh, so you had a similar situation.
Yeah. I'm actually starting a group called Uniquely Me. We're going to go out and like feed the homeless. It's just to bring the unity of us all.
Oh, that's terrific. That's really great.
I kept thinking, oh, I wish Grandpa were here, because he would love that. He would have just sat down and watched me go up and down the aisle. People were so happy to get a little orange. It doesn't take much to make people feel good. you know, if only for the moment. And if you tied a whole bunch of those moments together, people wouldn't be so stressed out.
In the early 1900s, Rikichi Maeda's mother died when he was 8 years old. His father was not a part of his life. He was left to be raised by his stepsisters, but they didn't want that responsibility. So they sent him away to a Christian mission.
They just took him in. And they raised him until he was like 18 or 19 and when he came to the United States. But as a result, he was already a Christian and he could speak a little bit of English when he got here. We did not know anything about him being orphaned until long after he had passed.
He died in 1964 when she was in college. Decades later, Sharon went to Japan to meet her relatives for the first time.
They were the daughters of his two stepsisters. They started asking me what kind of a person he was, and all of a sudden, both of them burst into tears. And the whole story came tumbling out.
Despite being abandoned by his stepsisters, Sharon's grandfather, he didn't hold a grudge. In fact, he helped support them from thousands of miles away.
He used to send money. I mean, how much money can you save as a red cap? They didn't make a lot of money. But he used to send money to his stepsister's children.
Sharon regrets that she didn't know this about her grandfather when he was alive. She still has so many questions for him.
You could miss a whole lot of wonderful, wonderful, or maybe even terrible stories, but things that are part of your history that you should know. I think it's just horrible when you find these things out when it's too late to have the conversation with them.
As much as she learned from her grandfather, Sharon says she will never be as good of a person as he was.
That story from sound effect contributor Yuko Kodama. Special thanks to KBCS. It's Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories of passing the torch. Marcus Harrison Green is the founder and editor-in-chief of the South Seattle Emerald. And he's also just written a new play. It's called Caucasians Anonymous. It's about treating racism as an addiction to whiteness, which comes with its own 12-step program. So how can somebody be addicted to whiteness? Well, here's how Marcus describes it.
I think whiteness is so intoxicating is because you can be ignorant to the rest of the world around you. You don't have to deal with racism, right? Unless you choose to. You don't have to question the structures in our society that put you at the forefront.
The play features five white characters talking to each other about their addictions. Marcus sat down with 88.5 Simone Alisea to talk about why he decided that white people must take up the torch of talking about racism.
Yeah, there was actually an event that I was moderating. It was a panel discussion after a showing of the film I'm Not Your Negro, which is essentially a James Baldwin documentary. And afterwards, before we could introduce the panel, a black woman stood up and fairly angry and wanted to know why, once again, there was a panel of mostly black people talking to an audience that was predominantly white about racism. She said, there needs to be white people talking to other white people about racism. And so that really struck a chord with me. She ended up storming out.
Right. So I think that kind of brings me to the thrust of this. People of color already talk about race. They already talk about whiteness to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But why do you think that people of color need to pass the torch on this conversation?
I think it is important that those who are the dominant within the society talk to others who are dominant in the society. To be quite frank with you, I think people of color can only do so much, but they hit a ceiling often in terms of their influence and effects and impact when they talk about race.
Yeah, so that kind of brings us to the play itself and, mm-hmm. you know, the path that you have taken in depicting how a torch might be passed. And that's this 12-step program, right. Caucasians Anonymous. You know, in what ways could a 12-step program help combat racism?
I think that the great thing about, the analogy with the 12-step program is it's realizing that this is work that consistently needs to be done. You don't go to one, you know, quote unquote, anti-racist training, or someone who's an alcoholic doesn't go to one AA meeting and then all of a sudden they're cured. Whether it's Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, you continue to come back, to continue to do the work. It's a realization that, you know, we can all slip back into bad habits. We can all slip back into our mindset.
Well, let's hear what that mindset can sound like. This is a little bit from the play where a character, Emily, is describing what brings her to Caucasians Anonymous. Emily is a teacher, and she's been sent here by the school district for touching one of her Black students' hair.
It doesn't matter that I don't have a racist bone in my body, and apparently 2 years in the Peace Corps in Ghana doesn't mean anything, or the Black friends I have, or being a card-carrying Democrat. Because, you know, you say something about a student's hair in class, I'm not sure when curiosity turned detrimental. I asked to touch her hair because I was curious about it, and she had these beautiful dreadlocks, and then she begins to throw a fit, calling it a microaggression.
Honestly, I think that's sort of a... I think that's a good example of what I call boutique liberalism. And I think that runs very rampant in Seattle. And I think when I say boutique liberalism, I sort of define that as this, you know, colorblind, you know, let's say all the right things. But then when it comes to actions, it's a bit harder to do.
We also have with us Marilee Jolin, who's the executive director of the South Seattle Emerald. You also played another character in this play, Marion, a white woman who's in a interracial relationship. Marilee, has this play and your experience in it made you want to pick up the torch in talking about race?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great phrase, I think, too, picking up the torch. You know, in the sense of handing it off to others, definitely. It's been, for me, that's been an ongoing process. So much of, at least for my family, the intoxication of whiteness has been never communicating about it with each other. But for me, that's mostly where that torch passing has been, is looking closer to home, looking in my own family, in my own relationships, and being willing to start conversations that are frightening but are really necessary.
Can you give me an example of one of those frightening conversations?
Sure. I found myself in January. I found myself in New Year's at a family vacation and really didn't mean to. I really thought I was just sitting down to watch football, but it turned out that we were going to discuss the new youth jail.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar, this is the new juvenile detention facility the county wants to build in Seattle. Voters, I think, approved the funds for it several years ago, but activists oppose it because kids of color are more likely to be incarcerated.
Yeah, the basic distinctions were that I think for a lot of white folks, because the system has never harmed us, because the system was created to benefit us, it can be challenging for white people to see the system as anything but an opportunity for individuals to improve. So something like juvenile detention, I was receiving a lot of input from my family about, like, well, why can't this just be a turnaround point? Like, here's how it has done good. Here's how I've seen it do good for other people in my life that were going down a wrong path. And then they went to juvie and then it improved. It felt like a really good start.
The conversation.
The conversation. We started, we talked about some things, and it has led to other opportunities. And I think that's maybe the most that I can ask of myself, or that any of us should be asking of ourselves, is to show up, make an effort, do it, and come back. Like, see those as long-term relationships that we are gonna continue to show up for, not like a one and done, right? Not like a come in and drop my 5-point essay and mm-hmm. can change minds and then move on. You know, that's a very individual, very white culture way of being, as opposed to thinking about, these are my people. They will always be my people, and I'm going to continue to show up in these relationships with this torch, right. As much as needed.
Yeah, I mean, and just to follow up on that, I mean, I think Marilee perfectly, you know, summed up why it is important for white folks to continue to talk to other white folks, because that's who they see, that's who they're in relationship with. That's, you know, it should be noted again that The reason that I wrote this play is really because I was challenged to stop talking about racism as a Black person, and I was challenged to have to provoke white folks into talking about racism with each other. A friend of mine who's also a writer, she talked about how she was just done talking about racism, especially after the Charlene Lyles killing that happened recently here in Seattle. She said, how many more times do I have to say something, rage on Facebook, post something on Twitter, write something, and it's just not going to change? She said, I'm at my wit's end, I'm exhausted, and I'm done and tired, and I just can't do it anymore. And somebody else has to pick up the torch. And I mean, like you said, and this is a point where I think we're handing the gauntlet off to quote unquote woke white folks who really want to do this work.
That's Marcus Harrison Green and Marilee Jolin talking with 88.5's Simone Alisea. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. Our theme this week is Passing the Torch. After World War II, when millions of Jews and other groups were murdered by the Nazis, the world made a promise to never forget. But soon the generation that remembers firsthand, the people who survived, will be gone. So now the torch is being passed to a new generation who will take on the responsibility to keep the survivors' stories alive. Michal Lotzkar lives in Kirkland. She grew up knowing that her father had escaped Poland in 1939, and she knew there was more to this story, but her dad did not give her a lot to go on.
I really got sips along the way. In hindsight now, I think that what was maybe going through their mind, and they couldn't really express it, is that on the one hand, they wanted me to know the history and the legacy of the family. But on the other hand, they wanted to protect me from it. And so nobody really talked about it. A story would come out here and there. And when he would tell me a story, I lapped it up. I craved it. I needed bigger gulps to satisfy. But I was young. I needed an adult to put it together for me.
And your father was young, too, in the war years, right? I mean, he was a child at the beginning of the war.
5 years old. 5 years old. They were expelled when he was five. And his memories are very childlike.
So how did this start to change for you? How did your relationship with this story develop as you were an adult?
When my daughter was in the sixth grade, her class went to the Holocaust Center on a field trip. I was a parent chaperone. And the docent that was touring them through was showing them report cards and pictures and passports and, you know, different things from survivors. And so after my daughter's tour, I said to the docent, I said, "Wow, my father has a bunch of those." And she said, "Oh, your father is a Holocaust survivor."
And what did you think? Had you heard him called that before?
No. You know, when I thought of Holocaust survivors, you know, I thought of camp survivors, ghetto survivors, Auschwitz survivors. And I said that to her, you know, my father wasn't in a concentration camp. But there's a whole spectrum of what survivors are and what different survivors went through. And absolutely, my father is a survivor. The family was expelled. They had to turn over the keys to their home, their worldly possessions, their bank accounts. They were kicked out.
What did that do to your curiosity? Like, where did you take it?
I got in touch with the folks at the Holocaust Center, and two people, Dee Simon and Richard Green, came to interview my father.
Okay, we're rolling.
And my father gave his testimony.
Good morning. My name is Arie Engelberg. I was born in Tarnobrzeg.
It was
near Krakow in Poland.
Raw.
In 1934.
And visceral.
And
childlike. He was talking in his testimony about his mother, my grandmother, wanting him to drink a cup of milk the morning of their expulsion. It's unimaginable to me what my grandmother was going through. She had three little boys. My father was the youngest of three boys. And here he is sitting in a chair in the kitchen, his legs dangling. And she doesn't know when the next cup of milk is going to come from, if it's going to come. And he doesn't feel like having a cup of milk. He's five. I think as parents, we can all kind of relate to that.
And hearing this story put together for the first time with these new details, this flesh on the bones, what did that mean to you? And what did it make you want to do or want to know?
I was mesmerized by how much he had to say, how much he wanted to say. For over 3.5 hours, it went on and on. And even after they left, after the interview was over, he kept talking.
I remember crossing this area, this border area. I was in my father's arms. It was at night. And the only thing I
remember... Arye Engelberg lives in Vancouver, BC now. He says he had never once told the story from start to finish.
The only time that I did openly speak about this subject was when I gave the testimony to the Holocaust Center in Seattle.
So between age like 14 or 15 and 80, this didn't really come up?
No, not really, no. Mostly because those were terrible times, horrible stories, and I did not want to feed them to my children. I believed they will be much happier without hearing the stories.
You think just hearing them is a kind of a burden?
Yes, it is.
Arye thought that for a reason. He remembers hearing his own parents' stories of pogroms and war and anti-Semitic violence. Did that stuff affect you as a kid?
Yes, very, very much so.
Do you remember how or in what way?
Kind of feeling very, very much of being pitiful and being sorry for my parents, particularly my mother. Remember until now, my mother holding me by my hand very strongly, and we were standing and watching the house burning down. And shortly thereafter, as I
Michal
said,
says, she was transfixed by her father's story. If hearing it was a burden, then it was one Michal was eager to take on.
I became at that moment acutely aware of how important my dad's personal perspective is. And my dad is 83, and I really felt a sense of urgency to tell his story.
And what were those interactions like? Did you get together specifically to talk about these things?
A lot of it happened in my original family home that I grew up in Vancouver. My dad telling me stories, looking at maps, explanations of his documents. I'm able to ask him to fill in missing pieces and to clarify certain things, and that in itself is wonderful.
Yes. Say more about that. What's that like for you as his daughter? I mean, how's it affected your relationship with him?
You know, it's interesting. My father is stoic in some ways. I don't know if that's a generational thing or maybe as a Holocaust survival. You don't want to express this love because it might be taken away from you. My father has never said, I love you. And it's always been curious to me. It's just been curious to me. It never bothered me because he's never had to say it. I felt very deeply always that his love runs so deep and so wide. His love always came through actions.
Arye's childhood was stolen by the Nazis, and he says he never really had the chance to learn how to express his feelings.
My relationship with the family, I think it was affected by all these events where there were crowded accommodations and no way to talk openly to parents. And it developed kind of personality that doesn't speak much and doesn't have any learning or education or tutoring how to how to do that. And it was not passed on to me by my parents. And I didn't know how to pass it on. And I probably did not. And I am always kind of hesitant whether I do it right or if I want to express my feelings of love and devotion and all that, whether I do it properly. I have a sense that I am very clumsy about it. I think my dear wife and my children can tell more.
When you say they can tell more, you mean you think that they know? They know what's in your heart, even if it's not in your words?
Yes, whether I express my feelings in the way that they accept it or they see it as a clumsy try. And we slowly, by me being forced to talk, that we slowly develop this relationship. I hope it's not too late.
So now Michal tells her father's story. She tells it to school groups, to visitors at the museum. She has a presentation with photographs and documents and snippets of her dad's testimony. She strains to get the details right, and she worries about whether, coming from her, it'll have the same impact. But she says sometimes she gets a clue that she's on the right track.
There was one engagement that I was asked to speak at, and one woman from Cambodia said to me, tearfully, "You are so lucky that you asked your father all of these questions, that he was able to share this with you. I wish I had that with my mother, and now she's gone." I felt, yes, this is why I'm doing this. Holocaust survivors are fading away. I'm afraid of him dying. Not only because he's my dad and I love him so much, also because he will take with him this history. And then when I want to know about a detail or I want him to retell a story to me, who will be there to tell those stories? So it's up to me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is Passing the Torch. Sometimes when stories get passed on, you don't always get the whole story, at least not in the beginning. For lovers of big band music who frequented clubs in the Northwest in the late 1940s and early 50s, pianist and saxophonist Billy Tipton was a fixture on the scene. But Billy was born Dorothy. This was a secret, though, even to those closest to him. Billy felt compelled to live out his professional and personal life as a man, and we don't really know all the reasons why. Sound Effect contributor Monica Spain talks to Amy Denio, a Seattle musician who has kept Billy's memory alive by naming a band after him, the Tipton's Sax Quartet. It blends jazz with other styles of music, and they continue to share Billy's complicated story.
Decided to start playing saxophone in the 30s, I guess, and auditioned for a big band, and they said, "Well, you play pretty well, but no, you're just not appropriate for the group," because at that point, women were mainly piano players or vocalists. It was very rare to find a trombone player or a jazz composer or anything like that. It was really frowned upon. And she came back a month later, having shorn her hair. Took her brother's name and said, "Yeah, my name is Billy." Played, and they said, "Oh, Billy, you play great, even better than your sister." You know, and so he got the job and just lived the rest of his life as a man. Was married 5 times, adopted 3 children, and just made that decision that maybe that's the way to go, to be able to fulfill all of his dreams. Who knows what they were? I never met Billy personally because he died in 1989.
And Billy Tipton was interesting because even he died in Spokane.
Yeah.
And while the paramedics were working on him in his final hours, that's when they discovered that he was anatomically a woman. And this was a surprise even to his son, who was there.
Yes.
And you said he had five wives.
Yeah. And I think that he died of a bleeding ulcer. It must have been a very painful end to his life. And he just refused medical attention because he knew the secret would come out.
When you put the band together in the late 80s, you chose Billy Tipton as somebody to remember by naming your band after him. And why did you make that choice?
So we decided this is an incredible story of someone who's passed as a man his whole life and had probably taken a lot of risks, emotional and otherwise, to follow their dream. And we thought, oh my goodness, we would like to name our group in honor of this person to help the story be known and to celebrate this incredibly courageous life.
Do you remember the first time you heard Billy Tipton's music?
Yes, I do. I'm not sure whose house it was. I guess it was Marjorie DeMonk's house, one of the original founding members of the Tiptons. And she had procured an LP. And I listened to it. I thought, wow, he's a really very solid player and playing Sweet Georgia Brown. Thanks to Billy Tipton and so many other women in the beginning of the 20th century, we can easily play saxophone and not get the comments like, my grandmother could play sax better than you.
In the earlier days, though, when you went to play in maybe some more out-of-the-way places, did you run into any sort of raised eyebrows or...
Well, years ago, we were organizing yet another European tour, and I got a fax from this guy named Pompeo Beningaza from Sicily. And so we played concerts all throughout Sicily. And during the day, I noticed really there weren't many women around in the streets at all. And so we began to think of it as a women's lib tour because at the concerts, women would come and they were just joyously grinning from ear to ear. And the men would have their arms crossed and their legs crossed for this, not quite scowl, but a look of disbelief. Like, whoa, these ladies can really play.
And in 2014, you were inducted to the Seattle Jazz Hall of Fame. And I guess that's not only an honor, but somehow maybe a responsibility to pass on what you know as a jazz musician to future generations.
That's really true. I mean, I feel so proud to be part of a generation which can do that. I do a lot of teaching. I work in schools. And it's so great to see younger girls getting the courage to do what they want to do. And so I find there's a prevalence now of a lot of young female saxophone players, whereas when I was a kid, I was, you know, handed the flute and that was that. So for me, it's all what people always ask me, oh gosh, it must be so hard being a female musician. Don't you come across, aren't you bitter? And I say, no, gender is, for me, has never entered the question. I just do what I like to do, you know, kind of like following the spirit of Billy Tipton. And I don't really worry about what other people think about me, so I just go ahead and that's the example I like to set for future generations.
Amy DiNio, thank you for being here and talking to us today.
Oh, Monica Spain, it's been a pleasure. It's great to see you again.
Thank you.
All right.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories about passing the torch. Out in Elma, Washington, there's a modest dairy farm. It's set against the backdrop of low hills and the cooling towers of the defunct Satsup nuclear plant. On the farm, cows are doing what cows do.
So there's the first baby.
Oh, how old is that cow?
Well, just like a couple hours. That's a couple hours. You know, new baby, you know, new mama. So what we do, we milk her, giving the first milk to the baby. So the first colostrums.
That goes to her own baby, not to
her own baby. That's the main thing. Give give the milk to their own baby, the first milk.
Jose Torres owns the place, but that wasn't always the case. Jose started out as an ordinary farm worker when this farm was owned by a guy named Bill Garris. Bill's father farmed around here, and so did his grandfather. But when it came time to pass on this land and this way of life, Bill didn't give it to his children. He gave it to Jose. Bill's wife Jenny explains how Jose became part of their family starting more than 20 years ago when Jose was new and barely spoke English.
He was working on things, winterizing the house. My kids all went outside to visit with him. The dog was in love with him. What stands out for my kids was he would drive the cat crazy or the dog or the chickens because he would talk. You know, my kids said he could talk all those languages with the animals. Like a rooster would go like berserk because Jose would tease it in chicken language, right?
Do you still speak chicken?
Oh, well, you know, I try.
Was it clear that Bill and Jose were becoming close?
Yes, from the beginning.
How could you tell?
Because he went to Bill and wanted to learn more, and Bill loved to teach. And so Bill never had to go to him and say, hey, you want to learn this? Do you want to get better at this? Like he would try to do often with the other employees. Jose would go ahead of him and say, hey, can I learn this?
I told him, like, if you show me how to do the job once, that's it. The next one is mine. I can do it by myself. And he loved that. And he teach me all that good stuff. Feeding the calves the right way, you know, the first milk, the colostrum for the new babies, the newborns. Bill was acting exactly like my dad. And I don't know if that's the reason. I just attached it to him really, really well.
So Jenny, you have how many children?
5 children. All adults, all employed, and 5 grandchildren.
And how many of them are farmers?
None.
So Bill's a third-generation farmer. His grandfather farmed, his father farmed, and then he took it over. Was there an expectation that your kids would take over the farm when he retired?
No, and he would never have retired. His dad didn't. And no, there was no expectation that they would farm.
Did that disappoint you at all?
No. Nor him. My husband encouraged all of them to be teachers. He thought a public teacher was the highest of calling, a public school teacher. And he tried to talk all of them actually into teaching school.
At what point did it start to become a question of, like, who's going to take this farm over when Bill can no longer farm it himself?
That only was after he realized he was sick enough that he was going to need to stop working. He was having intermittent pain in his stomach over a summer. He realized that it was more than just an intermittent stomach pain. And then he was diagnosed.
He was diagnosed with what?
Pancreatic cancer that had already metastasized to his liver. So he was on immediate palliative care.
When he was sick, you know, really, you know, that morning, and it wasn't really normal for me because he never missed a day, you know, here. He always show up, and he always been here at 5 o'clock. He started to feeding the animals. So I talked to him, Bill, you better just go and check with the doctor. That morning that he came and told me that what he had, it really changed my life. And like for a month, my head was spinning, you know. That was kind of hard, really, really hard. He's still present everywhere. And I believe he's one of the stars up in the sky. I still miss him.
What do you remember about the conversations around that? I mean, when it became clear that he was ill and there wasn't an obvious person in your own family, I guess your nuclear family, to take over the farm. So how did you sort of wrestle with that?
There was never any wrestling with who it would be. It was more like the timing had come a lot sooner. They were working on, I think, becoming partners. It just accelerated it.
So you decided that Jose would be the guy. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to Bill to have someone to pass the torch to?
An immense amount of peace. He loved being able to do that for Jose, to give him that opportunity. He wrestled with it because he wasn't ready to stop farming. So he never wrestled with the fact that it would be Jose. But of course, he fought pretty hard. It did not matter to Bill where a person was from at all. He loved learning about different cultures and different people. And so I think for Bill, he especially loved the fact that he was passing it on to a different culture and changing it in that way meant a ton to him.
He thought that that had value.
Oh, yes. I don't know if there are any other Mexican men who own farms in Washington. They may. I don't know if there are. And it wasn't necessarily important for him to be the first one, but it was very important for him to say that anyone can be an owner, anyone can be the boss. They don't all have to just be the employees. And he did that by doing it, not by saying it. He loved Jose.
Yeah. So you never feel like, oh, it would be nice if this stayed in our family, if our kids were still here, and maybe they could go into business with Jose or something? That just isn't on your emotional radar.
No, it's not, actually. I don't have any need to have things follow bloodlines. It's never been important to me. DNA is DNA, but my family is the people that surround me.
And that goes back also to where your kids come from, right? 4 of your 5 kids are adopted?
Yes, they are, and it does. But, you know, it comes down to my friendships. It comes down to the way I live my life. I have always been that way.
You know, Riker, their grandkid, he loved cows. He liked cows. You know, when he was around here, he comes and he likes to be with me in the tractor and all that. And who knows, maybe I told him, maybe I'm only a little bridge from now until if they want to farm later on, you know. It's all right. I understand. And if for some reason, someday they want to come back and want to keep doing on the family and all that, I'm more than happy the chance that they'll give me to being a dairy farmer.
Jose Torres and Jenny Garris speaking from Jose's dairy farm in Elma, Washington. That's all for the show this week. Special thanks to Jennifer Wing, keeper of the flame while I was gone. Thanks to producer Kevin Kniestead. And we say goodbye to one of the most talented, industrious, and creative people I've worked with. Producer Allie Ferguson leaves us this week to seek her fortunes out on the open road. No regrets, Allie. No regrets. Thanks also this week to Kyle Norris, Simone Alisea, Monica Spain, and Yuko Kodama. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can listen in your own sweet time and mine the archives by subscribing to our podcast. Find it on NPR One, iTunes, or wherever else. And there's always more at knkxsoundeffect.org. Come on back next week when we'll tell tales of royalty. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.